thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama hits the road to campaign for his jobs bill. The GOP claims a big victory in New York, and a newly released interview with Jacqueline Kennedy gives us a revised view of Camelot. Joining us for the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup, Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, Lisa Lehrer of Bloomberg News, John Dickerson of Slate.com, and CBS. Do join us. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Call us on 1-800-433-8850. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Jerry Seib, jobless claims hit new highs. And then we heard this extraordinary poverty report.
Right. It was a week of really not good numbers, if you're into crunching economic numbers. As you say, the jobless claims number that came out this week showed that they rose 11,000 to 428,000 last week, the second straight week in which jobless claims have gone up. That's usually an indicator of more unemployment numbers that are not going to be good to come. It may be that the more stunning numbers of the week came from the Census Bureau, which had done a look at family and personal income in this country over the last 10 years. And just some of those numbers I'll tick off for you. Median household income was down 2.3% from 2009 last year, and it's as low as it was since 1999. For men who worked full-time year-round in 2010, median earnings were $47,715. But for men, that's as low as it's been since 1978. The official poverty rate, as you mentioned, went up to 15.1% from 14.3% in 2009. It's the third consecutive annual increase in the poverty rate. So it's a picture of both not enough Americans working and those Americans who are working not making as much money as they were over the last decade.
John Dickerson.
A lot of people, in looking at these numbers, were talking about the lost decade. One of the things that struck me, in addition to the numbers that Jerry cited, was that the report revealed that from 2001 to 2007, which was a recovery, it's the first recovery on record where the level of poverty was deeper at the end of the recovery than it was at the beginning. And that was in terms of poverty, but also in terms of people seeing the gains they made in the 2000s just gone.
Lisa.
And politically, of course, there's huge implications for these numbers, particularly the poverty numbers. The hardest hit areas were in the suburbs, which tend to be, can be a little bit more swingy in terms of which party they go for. And of course, the Midwest and a lot of those states are, you know, huge swing states with tons of electoral college votes like Ohio or Michigan or Wisconsin. So this obviously has huge implications for Obama and
so
for the elections.
So certainly for the middle class, bad news. At the same time, you've got the president taking his plan on the road. What kind of reception, Lisa?
Well, Bloomberg News just did a poll that showed that 51% of people said that the plan would not lower the unemployment rate. So already before, and we sent our poll out in the field last week. So that was before he had sort of started pushing it, but he was still in the middle of making his pitch. And already more than half of people said that they didn't think it would work. So he's not going into this sales job with people feeling very, having high expectations.
And lots of criticism from John Boehner calling for total reform of the tax code right now.
Well, and this gets complicated. We've been in this place before where we have a short-term argument conversation and a long-term one. The president's argument with respect to his jobs bill, the $447 billion plan for jobs, is that deal with that by itself, offset the money to pay for that with some tax increases, which Republicans don't like. We should also mention with respect to that, that some Democrats have been balking at the president's bill, which is a big problem for him politically. But what Boehner's talking about in terms of fundamental tax reform, which takes a lot of time, as anybody remembers the 1986 tax reform debate, this is one of the things they're talking about doing in terms of the super committee in the House and Senate, in terms of finding perhaps as much as $4 trillion in savings or in deficit reduction, that this would be part of a grand plan. Well, doing that kind of a grand plan before the end of the year, as we've already seen things get seized up ever more by politics, that you would take on something that complex with that many lobbyists involved, fundamental tax reform, that is, not to mention the conversation the president has hinted at in his job speech last week about touching entitlements. Those are the two big things, tax reform and entitlement reform, that you'd have to do to get to this big $4 trillion number. And to do that by the end of the year in this historical moment in Washington, it seems a total impossibility.
So why did Boehner lay out his mandate right now?
Well, the odd thing about tax reform is that everybody in town in both parties wants to do it. There's a liberal argument about the corporate tax rate, for example, that says, well, if we're in a tax system which GE doesn't pay any income taxes, and we need more revenue and the only place to get it is through corporate taxes, then this system isn't working. And conservatives look at it and say, we have the highest corporate tax rate of any developed country. It's making us uncompetitive. We should fix it. Oddly, there's a consensus to do what John Boehner is talking about, as John indicated, though there's no time to do that right now. Now, the argument for a tax reform argument is more on the White House side right now is the only way you're going to get some additional revenue to reduce the deficit right now is to change the tax code because you can't raise anybody's rates 14 months before an election. So you close loopholes, you shift some things around, you change rates but don't raise anybody's bill, but you close some loopholes and you've raised more money. It's a deficit-cutting argument, but that's not the one Speaker Boehner is making.
So what's the expectation for the super committee?
Well, you know, that's interesting. A few weeks ago, I wrote a column in which I was pretty optimistic about the super committee because it's basically everybody in Washington was really shocked at the popular reaction to the show that went on in here this summer about the discussion about the debt ceiling and the deficit reduction package. People went back home. They were told it was awful. They don't trust anybody in Washington anymore. You guys can't get anything done. I thought that would lay the groundwork for the super committee to come back and succeed because everybody wants to succeed. But the vibes now really are not very encouraging.
I spoke to one member of the super committee the other night who said he had been optimistic, but that optimism has just gone.
Right. I mean, in the last few days, the White House has essentially said, we're not going to try to deal with Medicare and Social Security.
So what are they going to do?
And John Boehner has said, we can't raise taxes. So you do the minimalist possible. You know, you find some more spending cuts. You maybe close a few loopholes. You get barely to the $1.2 trillion they're supposed to come up with to avoid much more massive cuts. And then everybody goes on to the election.
And that $1.2 trillion leaves out the $447 billion of the president's plan. So that's the big problem, is that they have to come to an agreement if anything is going to happen on the president's plan. There's talk, even among some Democrats, about taking bits and pieces of the president's plan. The White House was of two minds or two messages this week. David Axelrod saying, nope, it's all one big bundle. Jay Carney, the spokesman for the White House, saying there was some chance that it could be put into bits and pieces. But we're talking about timing. There's also the question of when the Senate, the president is on the road saying, pass this bill now, pass it now. The Senate's got all this other business in front of it before getting to this bill. Harry Reid hasn't said when he's going to bring it up, I don't believe. And there's talk that he won't bring it up until after the end of this month. So there's the tension here always involved was, could the president create a sense of urgency? It's a hard thing to do, period. It's a hard thing to do at this stage of his presidency where people aren't listening in the polls. In addition to the Bloomberg one this week, the president's disapproval numbers went up. There is very much this view among some strategists I've talked to, particularly Republicans, but even Democrats. The more the president talks, the less people like him.
Lisa, how do you see it?
Well, of course, there's also this additional political pressure of the Republican primary, the presidential primary. And you have the Republican candidates, I believe Newt Gingrich called the super committee stupid. And I think Plenty, of course, is no longer a committee, called it very stupid. So that certainly doesn't make it any easier for Republicans in Congress when you have this type of political climate. And it makes sense for the candidates. They want to run against Washington. But it doesn't make them it doesn't make it easier for Republicans here to break that gridlock.
So back to the super committee, is your prediction, like John Dickerson's Jerry Seib, that they're barely going to get to that minimum.
Yeah, I think that is what I think. And I think even getting to the minimum is going to be harder than I thought a few weeks ago. Yeah, although I will say that the way the committee is set up, these are people who are close to the congressional leadership in both parties, and the leadership, therefore, has a stake in success, doesn't want to see failure, and the rules are set up so that it just takes 7 out of 12 members to pass something out of the committee, and a simple majority in the Senate and the House gets it through, easier than other things that happen in this town. So maybe the rules have been written for success.
Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal. Do join us. Send us your email and your tweets. What about that GOP party, Tea Party debate? Lisa Lehrer, how did Rick Perry do fending off all these attacks by other candidates?
Well, he started off and he seemed pretty prepared. You know, he was ready for the Social Security attacks from Mitt Romney, talking about it being his comments that it was a Ponzi scheme. As the debate went on, he seemed a little less ready for prime time. What was interesting to me was that he took some pretty intense hits from Michelle Bachmann, which showed that she's still in this. She's, you know, still going to try to play, and she could possibly impact his chances in Iowa. He wasn't really ready for comments about his HPV vaccine. He, of course, had, you know, mandated that by executive order, and that came under attack.
Awful lot of health executives, officials, physicians really criticized Michelle Bachmann for that hit on Perry. It was more about the timing and what he had done than about the HPV itself.
Well, it was on two fronts. One, it was on the smaller government front, which is that even though mandating vaccines is something governments do, they didn't want him to do it on that particular one. Also, they disagreed with, Bachmann raised the idea that there was a political campaign finance influence, that he was influenced by donations.
John Dickerson of Slate.com. Short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the Domestic Hour of our Friday News Roundup. Just before the break, John Dickerson, you were talking about Governor Perry and how he had fared during the debate.
He took abuse on the question of the HPV vaccine. He also was attacked on immigration, the policy in Texas of allowing illegal immigrants to have lower tuition costs for in-state schooling. What interests me, and then the Social Security problem was that he kind of ducked. On the one hand, he said, "I'm a truth teller," saying the system needs to be fixed, but he ran away from the position he advocates in his book, which is that Social Security should be perhaps returned to the state or given over to the states. What's interesting is will Romney beat back the Perry being the front runner in some of the polls? Is Perry's problem to the right? Because those voters who may be upset about the HPV vaccine or his position on immigration, where are they going to go? They don't particularly like Mitt Romney, Michelle Bachmann, they may like, but many of them don't think she's really going to be president. So where do those voters go? Or is Perry's vulnerability on this sort of an accretion of problems, which is that he's just not ready for a general election? He's got the Social Security problem. He seemed to be caught off guard on the HPV attacks during the debate. He just can't make it in a general election.
I think Romney is using Perry's candidacy to make his own electability argument that, you know, listen, Republicans, you all want to beat Barack Obama. That's the major goal here. I'm the one who can do that. I'm going to be more palatable to independent voters on issues like Social Security, in particular. And so that's sort of his main argument now. And he's trying to define Perry before Perry can define himself.
Jerry Zipew wrote a column the other day sort of bringing up the name of Ronald Reagan in connection with Perry.
Well, it's precisely because of this electability argument. That was, in 1980, very much the argument within the Republican Party about Ronald Reagan. Conservatives love him, but is he electable? Is he too extreme to win in a general election? There's an alternative. It was George H.W. Bush, the more moderate, more establishment candidate. Well, that's kind of the Mitt Romney character now. And the question is whether Rick Perry is now in the same place Ronald Reagan was in 1980, whereas he looks – conservatives love him, but they're not quite sure that he can be elected. And that's, I think, the best – as Lisa suggests, that's the best Romney argument, which is I can actually win this thing, and we can all agree that President Obama is vulnerable. Let's not blow it.
Did Michelle Bachmann help or hurt herself with his HPV question?
Well, I think that Rick Perry's taken so much of the oxygen out of the room for Michelle Bachmann that I don't know what she can do. I think she probably helped herself with some people, marginalized herself with others, and ended up in basically the same position she was in, which is not a very good one. I don't think she helped herself.
She helped Romney.
Yeah, she helped herself in a future Romney administration.
Right.
She talked about this woman that she had heard from, a mother who said her child had suffered mental retardation following an HPV injection. Some physicians have put out a $100,000 reward for somebody who finds that mother. Lisa.
That's sort of a pattern that we see with her. Not only is she able to gravitate to these issues that just spark criticism immediately, she also has sort of a tendency to, what aides have told me, repeat the last thing that someone has told her. She doesn't necessarily. So she heard that from mother. She spit it back out. But I think what's interesting is, you know, we looked back at her career all the way back from when she was, you know, a Minnesota school activist. And she was always able to glom on these issues or find these issues or was attracted to these issues that just exploded into sort of a lightning rod criticism, particularly social issues. So that's always been her career. And I think running for president is different than being on cable news. And that's what she's learning.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, she said a couple of things in that exchange that just wouldn't stand up under scrutiny. I mean, if you're going to be against mandatory vaccinations on this front, what about mumps, measles? You know, there's a whole. And by the way, she said no on healthcare. There should be no, the government shouldn't be able to mandate that anybody buy anything. Well, is that, what about auto insurance? You know, it doesn't really hold together. I will also note one other thing that where she is actually more with Rick Perry, but I think also they both may be having a problem with other parts of the Republican Party, which is on national security. They're essentially sounding neo-isolationist. You know, Rick Perry's practically saying we shouldn't have been in Iraq in the first place, and that's good with the Michelle Bachmann, Ron Paul part of the party. But the neocon part of the party hears that and they think, that's really not the national security message we want to hear either.
John Dickerson, I want to ask you about a new issue that's emerged this week regarding the Obama administration and whether there was special treatment to the solar firm, Solyndra.
Well, this was a firm that was given a loan guarantee under Energy Department program, and it's been investigated. Now it's gone under, and there have been raids of its offices. And the question was, did it get special treatment from as a part of the stimulus bill? And there are emails as a part of a congressional investigation that show, in fact, that administration officials were pushing and putting off putting pressure internally to sign off on the loan 2 years ago, so that Vice President Biden could announce the approval of the loan at a groundbreaking ceremony at the factory and say, "This is here. We've got our stimulus bill. It's the money is being directed towards good enterprises like Solyndra." So now the investigation is: was it being pushed? Now the question is: was it just being pushed for? Because they were trying to get the environmental reasons or also trying to get the stimulus money, trying to get it out and working because the economy is so bad. There's internal safeguards. The Inspector General's office had looked at this loan guarantee program and said there aren't enough internal safeguards. The loan guarantee program, by the way, existed before the Obama administration. It was started in 2005. The question is, was it rushed? Just because of the general rush to get stimulus money out the door, or was there something more nefarious at work? That second point has not been proved, but there are definitely emails that there was an internal push to get this loan guarantee.
Lisa.
I mean, I think this looks bad for the administration on three different fronts. First of all, it looks like sort of classic old Washington kind of things, you know, working government functions for political gain, which is, of course, what voters are really unhappy with. It deals with subsidies, and there's a lot of unhappiness with subsidies to different industries, everything from farm subsidies to, you know, renewable energy subsidies like this. And it also, the company, of course, went bankrupt. So that reinforces this view that or it can for some voters. It will reinforce this view that the Obama administration doesn't understand business. And
so,
that's something that trailed them.
How far is this question going to go? Could there be an investigation?
Oh, there will be an investigation. I think that it's
by the Department of Justice.
Right, and they've enlisted the FBI, which is why you saw FBI agents at the company's headquarters. But you're also going to now see a lot of investigation on the Hill. I mean, this is politically very juicy for Republican committees, and they're not going to let it go either. You know, ironically, from a business point of view, some people look at this and they say that getting that loan guarantee may have actually been the worst thing that ever happened for Solyndra, because they overbuilt when they got the loan guarantee, and private investors who had been kind of high on the company kind of moved away, because when the government gives you a loan, they're first in line to be repaid if something goes wrong. And private investors said, you know, that's not of much interest to us.
So what could this mean for this loan guarantee program?
Well, I think, as John indicated, what's been lost in here is this loan guarantee program went back to the Bush administration. It wasn't created by the Obama administration. It was it was in existence, and the issue was whether it was just flooded with too much stimulus money. I think the upshot is that people in the government will be much more reluctant, much slower, and much more miserly in giving out loan guarantees. I don't think it goes away, but it's going to be under siege and will operate differently.
And it's just a poster child for the attacks on the president, which is that it's attached to the stimulus, which is people don't think helped them, which Republicans have attacked for being ineffective. But also there's a larger philosophical argument, but to Jerry's point, which is this is what happens when government meddles. Government gets in there and tries, and the president's trying to even do it with his $447 billion program. He's trying to kind of tinker and fix and hit a narrow little target. And what ends up happening, Republicans will argue, is you end up messing up the actual business environment in which these companies are trying to operate.
And White House officials said Tuesday no one in the administration tried to influence the OMB decision on the loan. They stressed the emails show only that the administration had a quite active interest, and that's in quotes, in the timing of OMB's decisions. All right, Lisa Lehrer, you raised the congressional elections. Was Republican Bob Turner's victory in that safe Democratic seat formerly held by the disgraced Anthony Weiner in New York really a referendum on President Obama?
It may not have been a referendum, but it was certainly a warning sign for Democrats. And we've seen a number of those. Republicans raise more money. This past quarter, Democrats failed to flip the Wisconsin State Senate. So there's been a number of warning signs. And, of course, then there's been some flight within the base. There's, you know, one of the things that people have talked about a lot since that race was whether Jewish voters are turning away from the Obama administration. We've also seen that with environmentalists, people who care about the environment, and in some states that should be really his numbers have dropped in places like California and New York, states that really should be extremely strong for President Obama. So there is a question about whether he's losing the base. And I think a lot of Democrats, certainly, and they've said publicly, are feeling extremely nervous about this coming election.
And there was a second election the same in Nevada, which is worth noting, because that was a seat opened when Dean Heller, a congressman, Republican congressman, was appointed to the Senate. It's a marginally Republican district, but not overwhelmingly Republican district. The Republican won that special election by 22 points, which, you know, it's not surprising a Republican wins, but that's an excessively large margin. So I think, and that has none of the aberrational aspects of the Wiener seat. You know, it's a different state, totally different climate. And it tells you the big backdrop problem here for the Democrats isn't, Jewish voters or Anthony Wiener. It's the economy.
And John Dickerson, Elizabeth Warren has now join the field of Democratic candidates in Massachusetts. She's hoping to unseat Scott Brown.
Which gives us a sense of the volatility of politics, which is that, remember, the Scott Brown race was the first bellwether race of how badly things were going for the administration. The president went up and campaigned against Brown, kind of attacked him quite hard. It didn't work, and it was seen as a referendum for health care. Then we had it a few months ago. We had this in the 26th district of New York, a victory by the Democrat, which was seen as a referendum on the Medicare plan put forward by Paul Ryan, the head of the Budget Committee. Now we're seeing a total reverse in these elections this week. But Elizabeth Warren, yes, she's running. She went, a Harvard professor who's a consumer advocate, was supposed to have a position in the administration, didn't get it. She was in Boston campaigning, proving that she at least knew that the right thing to do is go out and touch human beings, which was seen as the problem for Scott Brown's Democratic challenger, not seen to be engaging enough. The problem is she's from Oklahoma originally, not a Bostonian. So we'll see how that works out for her.
Lisa.
And Scott Brown, of course, is the most popular politician in the state right now. And I think something like close to 70% of voters in Massachusetts don't know who Elizabeth Warren is. So this will be a marquee Senate race.
Lisa Lehrer, she's with Bloomberg News. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's a question from Eric in Covington, Kentucky. He says, you started your show today referencing the terrible economic numbers, but the markets don't seem to agree after a week of gains. What gives, Jerry?
Well, what you saw this week in the markets, the uptick there was entirely related to what's going on in Europe, not what's happening here. The economy here is dreary. Everybody knows that. The big drop over the previous weeks had to do with a fear that there was both the potential for a default by the government of Greece, potentially followed by other European governments, and the potential collapse of a big European bank or two because of all the bad debt that governments in Europe have accumulated. What happened this week was the big economic powers in Europe, Germany and France, seemed to get together and seemed to say, we will do what it takes to make sure there isn't a Greek government default and that big banks don't fail. It may not be true. I still think there's a good chance of a Greek default. But the market looked at that and said, maybe Europe won't go down in flames.
And here's a posting on Facebook from Jennifer. Was Bob Turner's victory in New York really a referendum on Obama? Or was it perhaps a referendum on Congress? Also, what does the panel think about James Carville's suggestion that Obama change his White House staff, John Dickerson?
Well, let's see. There's three things there. There's no question that Congress is unpopular. There's a new CBS poll out this morning that has its approval rating at 12%. I don't think they could get any worse if members came to your house and punched you in the nose.
Better
which
not.
Might be legislation they're offering next session. That is dismal, but the president's ratings are bad. There were some complexities here too in terms of former New York Mayor Ed Koch had said, let's make this a referendum on Obama, send him a message. There are also issues related to specifically because
he crosses
Israel
lines fairly often.
He keeps himself in the news,
yeah.
And so there's a lot of disappointment. This is one third of the district is Jewish. One third of those are Orthodox Jews, which tend to be more conservative. So there are some particularities to the environment. But the larger context is that even though people don't like Congress, and this is a huge question for the administration in 14 months for the election, is that even though they don't like Congress, the president tends to get more of the blame, and it may be more of the blame where they when elections happen and take place. Finally, just on the Carville thing, he said the president should throw, you know, start firing people, start panicking. I think that that's exciting advice. I think that when Jimmy Carter fired a bunch or tried to fire a bunch of his cabinet members, it sort of sent his presidency or continued the tailspin his presidency was in. Presidents can't be seen to panic because we don't allow them to panic. So the question for the president, the way in which he's constrained, is could he do anything that is so bold as to get to people to start noticing him again and listening to what he's saying? Does the presidency allow for that kind of boldness, or will people think, good gracious, he's really panicking?
Lisa.
I mean, our Bloomberg poll had that only 9% of people felt confident that the economy would not slide back into recession. So I think if the economy, people don't feel that their personal economic situation is improving, he can fire everybody. It's not going to make much of a difference.
Jerry.
Well, and this is no drama Obama. You know, his style in the campaign was not to panic in terms of shuffling people around at a time like this. I don't think he's likely to do that now. He does need probably some additional help working with Congress. I don't think the ability of the White House to affect change in Congress has been all that great this year.
Jerry, give me a quick rundown on what Operation Twist is.
Operation Twist. Okay, well, first of all, the name comes from something that happened in 1961 in the Kennedy administration as an economic a policy attempt, and the twist was a popular dance then, so somehow this got named the Operation Twist. In short, it's something the Fed might do, which is, would be to take a lot of short-term Treasury bills it holds now, which are designed to keep interest rates down right now, and turn those into long-term Treasury bills to keep down long-term interest rates. The Fed might just shift hundreds of billions of dollars from buying short-term to buying long-term. The idea is to keep long-term rates down. Maybe that keeps mortgage rates down. Maybe that gets people buying houses and businesses investing in the long run.
Good rundown. Jerry Seib at the Wall Street Journal. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, international news changes too rapidly to wait for the Sunday talk shows. Get insight and analysis from top journalists on the week's most important stories. The Diane Rehm Show. Next hour. And welcome back. It's time now to go to the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Asheboro, North Carolina. Good morning, Patricia.
Good morning. I'd just like to make a statement, Diane.
Sure.
It's quite obvious to a lot of us that the Republicans are going to make things just as hard as they can on everybody. So they're going to be assured of being voted back in the White House. A lot of us have not forgotten the Republican rule, and it's sad that they would be willing to tear this country down the way they are to be sure of a reelection. Thank you for listening.
All right. Thanks for calling, John Dickerson.
The president is going to try to remind any other humans who are not familiar with Republican rule what that was like over the next 14 months. And that's one of the things that the president's advisors are pushing and trying to remind people and get people to think about, because they would prefer this election not to be a referendum on the president, but in fact a comparison, which would include lots of bad memories about the people still hold about George Bush and his administration.
I think one of the more unfortunate things that Republicans have said in the last year and a half was when Senator Mitch McConnell, right after the 2010 election, said his top goal for the next 2 years was to see that Barack Obama was a one-term president. That opens the door for an assertion that all Republicans are interested in is bad news now, so they have good news next November. And it's going to be hard for them to push back against that.
Lisa.
And, of course, the White House is going to argue, as John said, listen, you may not be thrilled with us, but do you really want this guy or one of these Republicans? They've already begun doing that. They're going to try to paint the Republican presidential candidates as extremist as possible.
All right. To Cleveland, Ohio. Patty, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I would like a comment from the panel regarding the super committee. It seems as if they were given such a huge task to complete. I'm wondering why, with all of us so disenfranchised with our government, wasn't one or two goals set very similar that would be somewhat obtainable, very similar that you would do for children? And additionally, to make a comment or a question regarding loopholes in the tax code, it would seem to me that the corporations that have so many loopholes would have better resources to be able to absorb cuts.
John, I'm sure you laughed at the reference to children.
Absolutely, yes. It was a clever metaphor. And remember the president, when he was trying to work out the debt limit deal, was telling Congress that they were, he compared them to his own children and said, you know, my daughters get their homework done. You should be doing the same. So I think he would agree with the caller in terms of setting simple goals for children. I think that one, the size of the amount of money they're trying to get here, 1.2 to 1.5 trillion, which was the number everybody agreed on as a part of this deal, makes it hard to set simple rules. There's a lot to chew on in there. One of the things they did try to do is that the structure of the super committee is that if they can't come up with an agreement, then the cuts or the cuts kick in automatically. So that was, to continue the childhood metaphor, I mean, that was the or else. That was the punishment that was locked in the original agreement. And the super committee is trying to get its work done to forestall that, because it would be a potentially gruesome outcome to have those cuts across the board. But that's what they tried to do to break through the fact that everybody in Washington's behaving like toddlers.
All right. To George in Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning.
Yeah, thank you. Back to the Solara thing. I mean, can you imagine if this was George Bush and a contributor who had given over $53,000 to his campaign, if the company had visited the White House 20 times in 2 years, four times in the week before the election, or before the loan, and if they touted, you know, they touted it as one of their key emphasis, and $535 million goes down the drain right away. And the investigation is now under the control of Eric Holder and the Treasury Department. The cries for an independent counsel from the New York Times and Washington Post and probably NPR for sure would be astounding. I mean, this is, and, you know, people kind of shrug it off as politics as usual.
I don't think anybody in this room has shrugged it off, if you've been listening, George.
No, I mean, this is a big deal. I don't think it's being shrugged off at all. I mean, you know, we had pictures in our newspaper of the FBI carting crates of documents out of the Cylinder headquarters. I mean, this is a big deal. You've already had congressional hearings. You're going to have more. I agree with you, Diane. I don't think anybody's shrugging it off or pretending it's not a significant development.
All right. To Denise in San Francisco. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I've just been listening to the whole program, and I'd just like to make 2 points, actually. Daryl Issa promised the Republican Party that he was going to do nothing but investigate. I think they're going to find, at the end of this investigation into this new situation, nothing more than an administration that was objectively looking at something that might be beneficial for the economy. And we can't ignore that the Republicans, as early as 2009, the upper echelons of Republican thinking, knew that the only way to defeat Obama in 2012 is if the economy was bad. And I think a journalist and every smart American should be asking the question, how much of the American economy have the Republicans decided to forfeit so they can win in 2012? Because this was an artificial crisis that was generated by the Republicans, and the equalization of fault, like saying that everyone's acting like children in D.C., no. The Republicans, the flat-earthish, I don't believe in global warming or evolution Republicans.
All right, Jerry Syme.
Well, this goes back to the conversation I think we were having a couple of minutes ago, which is that the danger for Republicans here is that they will be seen as trying to tank the economy, not just observing the economy is in bad shape, but trying to make it worse. And that's not a politically advantageous position for them to be in. That's one of the reasons I thought this super committee might actually succeed, is because Republicans went home in August. They heard a lot of people complaining to them about the fact that things weren't getting done to deal with the deficit in the economy in Washington. I don't think they necessarily benefit from gridlock in Washington round two, and so maybe they have as much incentive to get something done constructively in the next few months as the Democrats do.
Lisa.
One thing that is interesting, though, is it's not just Republicans who are unhappy with the president's jobs package. It's Democrats as well. And, you know, several Democrats have said that, you know, they don't want to do a big package. They're certainly not moving it as quickly as the president would like. They don't like some of the tax cuts, things like that, in the package. And I think for the White House, that has to be a really scary dynamic. Democrats, they're simply don't, at least some, is particularly those in swing states, up for re-election, simply don't appear to fear the White House.
Here's an email from Mark in Little Rock. He says, can someone on your panel tell us what more exactly the president can do to work with Congress? He's compromised so much already that he's alienated a good portion of his base, and the Republicans have shown no interest in supporting anything the president has suggested, even things that they've supported in the past. John Dickerson.
This is perhaps the biggest overarching question of this whole election, which is Mitt Romney in the Republican debate used a line attacking Governor Perry of Texas and his economic record in Texas, and said, asked by the moderator, but didn't things turn out pretty well in Texas? And Romney said, well, you know, if you're dealt four aces, it's pretty easy to have a good hand. The reverse argument is being used by the White House, which is, the president was dealt a 2 and a 7, you know, a very bad opening hand in poker. And he's doing the best he can. But in terms of jobs in Congress, he puts out a plan. He gives the best speech at a bully pulpit that he can. He's deserted by members of his own party. The Republicans won't work with him. Short of waving a magic wand, there is nothing that he can do in the current system. And so that people need to look at what he's doing, not based against a perfect ideal, but based against the hand he was dealt and continues to be dealt. And he's got to convince them to see the world that way. Mitt Romney won't help him, even though Mitt Romney used a version of the argument himself. He's got to try and convince the world to see things that way so that they can evaluate him against that measurement and not a higher standard.
Just two thoughts. One is, I'm not sure the president did himself any favors by proposing to pay for the whole jobs program with revenue increases, knowing that opened the door to Republicans saying, it's exactly what we can't support. It shows you it's all politics on the one hand. On the other hand, we shouldn't lose the sight of the fact that I think at the end of the day, when the rhetoric dies down, there's a big part of what the president proposed that probably will get done, which is an extension of the payroll tax holiday and an expansion of the payroll tax holiday, which is actually a very big deal, and actually it contains a lot of money, and which I do think Republicans are going to find it hard to oppose. It basically says to workers and employers, you'll pay less in payroll taxes for the next year. Put money in pockets, maybe make it a little easier to create jobs. It's a tax cut. I think that's the one piece that will probably survive.
A lot of our listeners have been asking how they can send their thoughts to the Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction. Their website is linked to ours at drshow.org. So if you'd like to do that and make your own thoughts known, go to drshow.org. Let's go now to the U.S. Virgin Islands. Good morning, Freddie. Wish you
Hi,
were here.
Hi. Okay, yes, I was just listening to the program, and I would just like to make a few comments. I think that the president is doing a very, very good job, and that he took the country from a very difficult situation and brought it to a state where it is more stable. I mean, there is a lot more work that needs to be done, and it's not going to take just the Democratic Party to bring the country to a position where it is stable. And everything is moving fine. I believe it's going to take the Republican and the Democratic to come together and put their differences aside and really fight for the common goal for everyone in America.
And that's precisely what many have been saying. John Dickerson, is it going to happen?
No, I don't think so. You know, there is a when you listen to the president talking about his making the case, starting the campaign, calling on people to send in tweets and messages to and letters and carrier pigeons to Congress, you know, what's happening here is that he's campaigning for his jobs bill in a way that, and Jerry mentioned the fact that he's going to pay for it with, or has suggested to pay for it with things that immediately set off Republicans. That one Democratic strategist said, you know, it's just silly for you, speaking to me, to even think about this jobs bill as anything other than a political exercise. And if that's the way people are thinking at 14 months out, that this is all pre-positioning for the election, that the president's doing these rallies, yes, to maybe try and sell something, but to really gin up his supporters and connect with them in these key battleground states. He's not going to places that aren't battleground states. That this is all a part of the election that has already begun. If that's true and everybody sees things that way, it's hard to see folks coming together.
John Dickerson of Slate.com. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I wonder, Lisa Lehrer, what your reaction was to the release of the Jacqueline Kennedy interviews.
Well, I thought they were fascinating. And one of the things I thought was really, really interesting about them was that how she presents herself as this very traditional wife. You know, she said she got her opinions from her husband. They never fought. And that's a really different picture than the Jackie Kennedy that we knew sort of later when she was a book editor and she seemed very independent. So I thought that was really interesting.
She also said she did not think women should run for political office, that they should be at home to create equanimity and peace in the home for their husbands. I was surprised at that.
Pretty surprising, although, you know, she was a product of the 50s. And while she was saying that, she was home thinking some pretty sophisticated political thoughts at the same time.
Yeah.
So and sharing those thoughts with her husband, the president, which I thought was particularly interesting. What jumped out at me was and this is just a confirmation of what you already knew, but the disdain with which the Kennedy team held the Kennedy vice president, Lyndon Johnson, and his successor as president. There just was no love lost there. And she was quite blunt in saying that the President Kennedy worried about what the President Johnson would do to the country if it came to that.
Jerry, I understand there is another group of tapes scheduled to come out 50 years from now?
Well, my understanding is that there's another set of tapes in which she talks with William Manchester and other historians specifically about the day the president was shot, and that those did not come out and will not come out until later. And that's pretty dramatic stuff, too, I'm sure.
What interests me here in that Lyndon Johnson, I mean, Johnson, both when he was vice president and then even when he was president, fought against that image the Kennedys had. It obsessed him that they didn't like him and never thought he was good enough. But is the extent to which 34 years old, this widow is managing the after story. I mean, we also should talk about her meetings with Teddy White, the Time magazine writer and historian, where she coined the phrase Camelot. In his copy for Life magazine, writing about this period, when it was released by the archives, her editing notes are in the margins. I mean, she was participating in shaping the story there, shaping it in the Schlesinger interviews, shaping it in the Manchester interviews. And now we have her daughter deciding to release 47 years later.
Why?
I don't know. It's a brave thing to do with respect to history, because there are a lot of ways in which her mother doesn't come across that well here. So you could imagine if you wanted to protect in a glass case this image, you would keep all of this out of the public view. But it's a great thing in terms of history of that extraordinary time, not just because a president was killed, but because if we look at the views of a woman, this was a period in Washington where Washington was changing, where the entire country
Absolutely.
Was changing. This was turned Washington into a glamour show, and she was at the center of it. And so she wasn't just the wife of a president who died. She was herself this extraordinary figure. And so it's a great gift to history.
And you do wonder if she knew she was writing history. So did that influence her opinions and her portraying herself as this very traditional figure? Michael Beschloss, who did the foreword, found a correlation between the people she ran down in the interviews and those who had difficulties in the administration. So she clearly... there's no question she was influential.
She had not very nice things to say about the Reverend Martin Luther King.
No, although, that's also just furthering what people already suspected, which was that there was a lot of tension, particularly between the Kennedy brothers, John and Bobby, and Martin Luther King, and that spilled over, even while they actually worked together on some important civil rights questions.
Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, Lisa Lehrer, Bloomberg News, John Dickerson of Slate.com. This hour has been videotaped. We'll have some portions of it up on the web in about an hour. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.